I take it that what we've just sung is what we're praying. And in that spirit, I'll ask you to turn with me, please, to Matthew's Gospel and chapter 5. I think you'll find it a great help to have it open in front of you. Well, the great headline everyone longs to see in the newspaper, isn't it, is Man Bites Dog. But normally, it is, I'm afraid, the other way round. And it's the usual story because there's not a great deal to write about it the other way around, but the journalist has to go along and discover how it happened, that someone or other got savaged. And so often, isn't it, it was a friendly pet, it had been a companion for years, and suddenly one afternoon, the owner, the child, got bitten, savaged. They knew him well. He was tame. They were all relaxed at home, comfortable with him. And one day, the real nature of the dog was revealed, and he turned into some snarling creature. Well, when Jesus revealed God's view of God's law, and that's what we're studying in this series, it must have been a bit like that. Opening the subject would have brought no more quiver of excitement than the headline, Dog Bites Man. The Pharisees, the religious people of the day, had come to a good understanding with God's law. They were at home with it. They felt comfortable in its presence. They grasped it. They were confident. They were relaxed. And then as Jesus spoke to his disciples in that Sermon on the Mount, this tame creature revealed its true nature. And what makes it so uncomfortable is that in doing so it revealed our true nature. I confess that I've shied away from studying in the Sermon on the Mount for many years. I've heard too many people who, by everything else they said, were incredibly woolly about their beliefs, tell me that the one thing they did believe was the Sermon on the Mount. And I thought if that's all that it had done for them, I wasn't going to waste too much time on it. This week's study has changed all of that. And the little I've glanced ahead tells me that next times won't be any more comfortable. One commentator put it this way, the Sermon on the Mount is not, repeat, not, soporific sentimentality designed to induce a kind of feeble-minded do-goodism. So if that's what you want from your religion, now's the time to leave. Look at the lead-in to the passage we're studying tonight. Look at verse 20, will you? Jesus, as he starts on his illustrations of his theme, says this, I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Take the most moral people you know. Those were the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, unless your righteousness exceeds theirs, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. This is going to be something that will cut deeper than anything any Pharisee ever imagined. It is more outrageously radical than the listening disciples could have believed. I've come to see already that these examples we'll be studying this term will form what I can only say with British understatement is an awkward morality. An awkward morality. Now, morality and moralizing has in some circles become something of a dirty word, hasn't it, these days? It is something that's good to avoid. Indeed, some people go to great lengths to avoid it, and at all costs, it seems we must be seen to be avoiding it. So people preface their comments, don't they, with something like this. I don't want to comment on the morality of it all, but... I'm not making a moral point here, they say, as if that gives their statement a plus. We mustn't moralize, we're told authoritatively. Well, we'll discover these verses have an awkward message for the I don't want to moralize, I don't want to say anything is right or wrong brigade. Jesus does want to moralize. The great figure of compassion is not above moralizing. To those who suggest that there's really no law now, or all things are relative, Jesus says in these verses, God has revealed His will. You can't have Jesus on your side if you want to be a no-moralizing person. Even on delicate issues like divorce, you'll notice down in verse 31, He lays down the law. Now, some general synod scripts might have to be rewritten if we take these words seriously. But, and this is the point that made me sit up and take notice, this is what makes this such awkward morality. Do you see how awkward He is? Not just for those who don't want to morality, but for those who do. How awkward Jesus is for the moralizers. Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the great moralizers of their day. Let's be clear that this will be an awkward few weeks for those of us who complacently pride ourselves on being the moral majority. The chapter describes Christians. The chapter is full of comparisons. But the comparison is not between the out-and-out pagan and the Christian. It's between the moral person and the Christian. Look at them all. Time and time again, you find Jesus saying what He says in verse 21. You have heard that it was said to the men of old. You have heard that it was said. Comes 6 times in this chapter. And the next verse, every time, gives the contrast. But I say to you. So the comparison, it's not between Jesus and Moses, Jesus and the law, it's between Jesus and distorted law, Jesus and traditional morality. And tradition has done what tradition always does. It's relaxed and debased the law. Tradition so often makes the law's demands less demanding and the law's permissions more permissive. Jesus, we'll discover, is going to reverse both of those. Now you see, if I come in to this series all in favour of morality, I hope we're beginning to realise I might still leave with my eyes popping out and finding I'm on the wrong side of these comparisons. I could still be gasping at my own spiritual bankruptcy. I wanted to call this series Moral Minority simply because there's only one person who ever lived it. And my prayer is that there's no trace of smugness in my voice these weeks. I am not in any position to point a finger. An awkward morality. Let's focus in on where we will be tonight and on Jesus' first example. Verse 21. Well, actually, verse 21 and 22. What I've called license to kill. You have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. I don't know about you, but at first sight, it seems difficult to see what was wrong with tradition in this instance. You shall not kill. Well, literally the word means, and a better translation would be murder. You shall not murder. It's talking about that rather than capital punishment, just war, whatever we think of those things. You shall not murder. We say that's in the Ten Commandments, isn't it? And it is. Whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. That's in the Old Testament, isn't it? Yes, it is. Capital punishment. Well, what's wrong then? What's wrong is rather subtle. What's wrong is that when I put the two together, when I put the two together and imply that that is all that is meant by you shall not murder, that's when I've weakened and debased the law. When I've left it so that what it says is, if I do not spill blood, I have not broken the commandment, That's when I've robbed it of its power. No murder. No problem. No, that's not how God sees it. That's defining it in a way which allows most of us to escape. I take it that many of us, tonight we know what's coming. In a sense, we realize that that superficial treatment isn't sufficient. We might be surprised how many people love to leave it at that level, love to console themselves by the fact that they've not committed this crime, so it has nothing to say to them. I remember being at one dialogue supper evening, discussing Christianity with some people, and they were churchgoers. And as is often the case with churchgoers, they were more offended than those who don't come to church at the idea that they might be sinners. And the person who became their spokesman, who was particularly indignant that I should speak as if he, like me, was a sinner, protested. Said he'd never done anyone any harm. Reminded me of the incident the day before when a policeman had been murdered and said he'd never done that. And he doubted if anyone else in the room had murdered either. And he looked at them all at that point, and one by one they shook their heads. And as it was obviously about to become me versus the rest, I was quite grateful they did shake their heads. But you see the fallacy, don't you? You see how they're treating it exactly as tradition has it in this verse here. And Jesus points out what license that leaves me with. Jesus in verse 22 tells me that this is the true understanding of that commandment. I say to you, everyone who's angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Murder is a crime not of the hand but of the heart, Jesus is saying. If you've ever whiled away a rainy day reading an Agatha Christie and that obnoxious Belgian detective Hercule Poirot, you may have come across him in one of his philosophizing moods. In one of them he says this to his stooge, Hastings. Now you must realize this, Hastings. Everyone is a potential murderer. In everyone there arises from time to time the wish to kill. How often have you not felt or heard others say, she made me so furious I felt I could have killed her. I could have killed X for saying so and so. I was so angry I could have murdered him. All those statements are literally true. Your mind at such moments is quite clear. You would like to kill so-and-so. Well, I wonder if Mr. Poirot knew what authority he had for saying such things. You see, Jesus looks straight into our hearts. And he says that's where God looks, and that's where God judges, and you don't have to have committed the act of murder to have the heart of a murderer. Everyone who's angry with his brother. By the way, that's not just flashpoint anger, you know, that temper that bursts out in a slanging match. If anything, the Greek word is speaking more of a deep-seated brooding anger. You know, that you just let fester. We can be coldly angry, can't we? As well as hot-bloodedly so. And when that's in our heart, when anger's in our heart, it often shows in our eyes, if looks could kill. Yes, an angry heart. Whoever insults his brother, Jesus says. There's a despising note here, a kind of intellectual snobbery. Whoever says, raka, empty, to someone. Whoever says, you idiot, you blockhead. Shall be liable to the council. Too many of us here have brains to be able to read that verse comfortably. Intellectual snobbery comes too easily to us. Whoever says, you fool, there's a moral connotation there, isn't there? There's contempt. Whoever has that kind of contempt shall be liable to the hell of fire, to the Gehenna. The word Jesus often uses for hell, it speaks of the rubbish dump outside Jerusalem. If we rubbish someone, we'll be rubbished by God. The language of bad temper. The language of a brooding anger can be a good indicator of the condition of someone's heart. And we know it. We talk of character assassination, don't we? Of wounding comments. You see, in summary, Jesus is saying this: anger is actually just as bad as murder, and the punishment for it is hell. And I balk at that kind of summary. Jesus is not saying in verse 22, so do be careful what you say. No, that'll be to limit and crimp the law again. What he's actually saying is this: expose my thoughts to God's penetrating scrutiny and see how serious it is to have this kind of heart. And I find myself wanting to say, yes, but not as serious as if I was a real murderer. And Jesus keeps on insisting on lumping the two together. Let me try and illustrate it. Have you ever wondered about those odd lists in the New Testament of sins? I mean, odd because they seem to be put together all higgledy-piggledy. Let's have a look at a couple. Romans chapter 1. Tell you the page number when I can get there. 143. Verse 29. Paul writes, they were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, and so on. Now, there's murder right in the middle. Well, we can understand that if you want a list of the bad things. But isn't it odd that in the same breath and without distinction, he mentions things like malice, strife, malignity, haughty? We can't treat them all the same, can we? Well, it's not Paul on his hobby horse. He's merely reflecting Jesus. Turn back to Mark chapter 7. This is our only foray away from Matthew tonight. So we'll make the most of the trip. Mark 7, page 40, verse 21. Well, verse 20, Jesus speaking. Jesus said, what comes out of a man is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery. We can understand fornication, theft, murder, adultery, but why put evil thoughts in the same bracket? They're at it again. Yes, they are. Jesus is saying these are the same heart. And whenever I'm saying, well, it's not the same, it's because all the time I'm saying it doesn't have the same effect on the victim. It may not. Jesus isn't thinking of the victim at this point. He's actually speaking about my heart. You see, the Pharisee is not concerned with sin until it blossoms into action. He doesn't think you shall not kill has any effect until murder is physically committed. Jesus knows that that leaves, if not license to kill, at least license to have a killer's heart. So I say to you, he says, everyone who's angry with his brother, who insults his brother, who says, you fool, shall be liable to the hell of fire. A killer's heart. And what's his response? What's the remedy for a killer's heart? Why, in these last four verses, in verses 23 to 26... he's urging us to take immediate action. immediate action. Two pictures in these verses to highlight the importance of what we've been saying, the urgency of dealing with it. And from them we'll learn lessons of what true repentance is all about. Let's take the first one, verses 23 and 24. It's quite a clear picture, isn't it? It's some people who are at the altar. By the way, altars weren't all over the country. This almost certainly, he's speaking to people in Galilee. He's almost certainly thinking of one of their rare pilgrimages to Jerusalem. It's a big effort. It's an important occasion. They brought a gift, some animal sacrifice. As laymen, they're allowed into the priest's court for the sacrifice. The gift is on the altar. The sheep, the goat, the pigeon, the dove, whatever. The knife is at the animal's throat. And then they remember. Now then they remember, end of verse 23, you there remember your brother has something against you. Now what do you do? First, says Jesus, it's a matter of priority. First thing you do when you get back to Galilee is to sort it out with him. That's not what he says, is it? It's actually even more strict than that. It's even more urgent. He'll interrupt even so important and solemn an occasion as this. He says, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, even before the knife slits the throat, first be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. The sacrifice will be meaningless until you put things right first. I can't worship with grudges. And sing until the cows come home, the praise of God. It'll be meaningless if I've not been reconciled to my brother first. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. To obey is better than sacrifice. Yet we don't really take verse 24 seriously. Most of us love to substitute service or ceremony for integrity and purity and love. And Jesus will have none of it. You see, he's telling me here that repentance in this matter is not doing something, even doing something religious, to make up for the wrong. I don't know if you found these verses convicting tonight. If maybe you're rather alarmed that you're discovering what your heart is like and it's not pleasant. Well, if that's the case, please don't reply by saying, well, at least I'm doing so and so. Don't fob God off with, look, I know I shouldn't be like this, but it can't be that serious. After all, I have made it to Jerusalem. I'm giving decent sacrifices. Don't think, well, the preacher may have a point, but it can't be that bad what he's saying. I do at least come to Sunday at 7. I've even done my Read, Mark, Learn homework this week. No, that's not the picture. Look at his second picture. Look at verses 25 and 26. Make friends quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out till you have paid the last penny. Here's not a religious service, here's a court case. And here again is a matter of great urgency, isn't it? Make friends quickly with your accuser. Why? Think of the possible consequences. Jesus is not giving us good advice in these verses. He's giving us an urgent command. The consequences, he tells us, may be huge. We could find ourselves in prison until the last penny is paid. And if you're a debtor and you're in prison, you can be sure the last penny will never be paid. What he's saying is this, isn't it? If we leave things, if we let them drift until we come face to face with God's judgment, If we've not forestalled God's judgment by repenting and being reconciled, do understand God's judgment will know no half measures. And none of us knows how long we've got until we face God's judgment. So make friends quickly. And make friends, he says. You see, again, the tone of these examples is this, isn't it? Repentance is more than me saying sorry to God. It's more than us just stopping at the end of this service and confessing our fault to God. He does not say, when you're there with your gift and you remember your brother has something against you, then pray. He does not say, if you're heading for a court case, make friends with the judge. He says, no, make friends with your accuser. He says, be reconciled to your brother. Notice the one's a brother, the other may not be. May go outside Christian circles. Now that's what's challenging, isn't it? I confess that I find it much, much easier to say sorry to an unseen God than to apologize to my brother or sister face to face. But what was that prayer of sorrow to God worth if I'm not willing to be reconciled? Do you begin to understand all this talk of the hell of fire, of the consequences till the last penny? It's not a sledgehammer to crack a nut just because I was angry with someone the other day. Everything in me, and I suspect everything in you, is against us swallowing our pride and going and making up with someone. I need to see how serious it is to let that fester in my heart. You say, what will it mean? Well, I don't know exactly what it'll mean for people here tonight. For some, it might well mean an apology. It may mean that you've got to find someone out in this crowd or over at After Eights afterwards and actually apologize to them. Typically, they'll be away because it's a bank holiday tomorrow, so you'll have to get hold of them at some other stage and do it. I don't think I'm watering this down. Correct me afterwards if you think I'm wrong. But I don't think the nature of these examples means that if, when I woke up in the middle of the night last night, I thought all sorts of bitter, evil thoughts against Gareth that I've not yet had time to communicate to him, I have to go up and load him with my burden of guilt about that. So cheer up, Gareth. That I can confess to God. Only he's heard them so far. But it does mean that if Gareth and I are actually not on speaking terms, and you'll be amazed how many churches there are when there are people who will not speak to one another. Not because the place isn't friendly, but because for some petty or some major reason, she sits there and he sits here, and never the twain shall meet. If relationships have soured and gone wrong, then it does mean I apologize. Both sides in both these examples know there's something wrong. It may mean an apology. It may mean restitution. Giving something back, even paying something back. So I was reading in preparation for this, I came across an extraordinary incident. If any of you know the Keswick Convention, you'll find it hard to imagine anywhere where you have more honest, upright, sober, conservative people than go there. And yet I discovered that in 1903, and we're meant to think that was more sober, upright, honest and conservative than today, in 1903 someone said this, speaking on this passage to the Keswick Convention, "First go to your brother and tell him you've done wrong and make restitution. Write out the check tonight," he said, "and send it. Add the interest. write the letter of apology and say, excuse me and forgive me. And the post office at Keswick ran out of postal notes and money orders. It may be there's some financial restitution. Maybe you have to make a phone call. Maybe you've never spoken to parents for some long time, and someone needs to put that right. Well, whatever it is, what I'm really wanting to say tonight is this: do it quickly. Do it quickly. It's vital we do it quickly, because it's vital it's done. They've invented checkbooks since those days of Keswick, so that's simple. We can write the check. Put it in the post tonight. I know it won't get anywhere tomorrow, but if it's in the post, you can't get it back out again. If you wait till tomorrow morning, you'll think of 101 excuses why you shouldn't send it. If you've got to make the apology, and you can find the person, if you've got to make the phone call, do it quickly. Don't let after 8 beef burgers lessen your resolve. I don't just mean it funnily, it's a serious bit, isn't it? You see, when God speaks to us and we say, yes, that's right, and I've got to do it, it seems so clear, so obvious. A couple of beef burgers later, it can be much woolier, can't it? Use a phone in the office if you like. You press one button for line one, then dial your number. And to save you having to do another apology next week, leave the money by the side. You've heard it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill. And whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. That leaves license for a killer's heart. I say to you, everyone who's angry, whoever insults his brother, whoever says you fool, should be liable to the hell of fire. If that's you, act quickly. Immediate action. Be reconciled to your brother. Make friends quickly with your accuser. Well, where do we go from here? It seems, after what Jesus has been saying, that there's not much point in singing a hymn, is there? I mean, he doesn't say sing a good hymn and then go and do it, so we've cancelled the last hymn. We're going to be quiet. And after we've had a time of quiet to reflect and decide, we'll leave. Some of us may have to do business with others first. I do want to urge us all, put things right with our brother, our accuser. Do it this week. Then come back next week in just the mood to hear about the fresh start that Jesus offers. You'll have that moment of quiet. Let me start it with these words from the psalmist. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting.